So tonight we're opening up the next chapter in our Distortion of Mind series, and we have two talks left. This talk is on the moody mind, and next week's or the week after's talk will be on the boring mind. So we have two topics left, and I chose the moody mind rather deliberately, rather than having an expression of the moody mind, which are one of the many, many different emotions we might have. I could certainly talk and have talked about them in detail, but sometimes we forget that often behind the attitudes we form and the way we embrace the world and the expectations we hold of the world and the way we get fed from the world has to do with a kind of inclusive view of mood that we may be going through at the particular time that an incident or an occasion or an event occurs. And we miss how the mood affects the exchange, the relationship, the event, the experience that might unfold. And I think it's really worth looking at mood itself, the moods that we have, as to how these patterns, if not perceived, really begin to form a kind of character, a kind of way that we hold the world, a sort of expectation that we have of ourselves in the world or that we have of the world for ourselves. And any coloration, remember that any coloration, any mood that we have assumed to be true, any emotion that we assume to be true, must have a distorting effect upon reality when we see through that mood, as it would be if we had different colored glasses looking at the world through the different tints of color. So moods can be of one emotion or several mixed emotions, but sometimes some of the frequent ones are self-pity. We can have a self-pitying mood where life has gone, has betrayed us, such as the poem I read at the beginning. And kind of way that we start feeling that we're, you know, being dumped on by life. Or hostile. There can be a hostility, a sort of way that we have defended ourselves from aggression or infringement on our rights or whatever, and we can hold this kind of hostility, which can become a mood, a part of our character. I'm just giving you some of the many different ways that a mood can form. We can have an indignant quality or an arrogant quality to our posture. We can have a very pleasing quality, which is very attractive to people, and we maintain a quality of sweetness so that, like bees around a flower, we attract people through that particular cultivation of mood. Or we can be righteous, or we can be dull. We can be oppressed or repressed or pressured. It can take multiple forms. So I'm not focusing in on one aspect or one form of the mood, but rather the sense of having a mood at all, that sense of me that is formed from the mood. Many of us, and one of the things I ask the beginning class when they come in is check out your attitude, because your attitude is often fixed within a mood that you have. How you get up out of bed in the morning, how you carry the day. And we don't even know that that's occurring. We just assume that that's the fact of the day. That's just the fact of the life. So I would call upon each of us here to look and see what mood we might be carrying into this talk this evening. Just to know that is there. And in the beginning, when we become self-aware, we can see how driven we are by that mood. We can begin to perceive how much of a fix that mood has upon us, and how much it holds us to a kind of emotional display, maybe a sense of self-defensiveness, many different ways that the mood can distort a kind of open flexibility that we would otherwise that would otherwise be available to us. And for people who first see that, it can be rather startling. They may have lived their whole life, say, within self-pity, and they don't realize how the very way that the whole world brings forth that energy of infringement, which leads to further pitying oneself. What dawns on people at first when they see that is they need to control it. They need to get a sense of it. They need to be able to get out of this thing. And oftentimes, early on, we become very fearful that we will be consumed by these moods that hold us in such a fixed position to life. And we may even become obsessed in ourselves in trying to get out of it. And all of this, actually, the control, the fear, and the obsession, actually reinforces the strength that the mood has over us. We don't realize that the strategies we employ to get out of the mood are the very strategies that force the mood into more adherence, into a tighter container around us. We can't wiggle out of our character. All we can do is disprove the mood, to prove that it isn't true. And then it doesn't have the personal capacity, the implications that we project on it. We don't give it the strength any longer. When we can see that whatever form the mood might be taking, ultimately, when you really check it out in clarity, not through the distortion of the mood itself, but in moments of clarity, that this is not true. If it were true, it would be true forever, would it not? It's what happens to the way the world looks when you're not in that mood. It looks very different. It looks very different, and it doesn't dawn on us that the reason the world looks so different is that we're not in that mood. The mood is the way the world is looking. Is how the world looks. But in those moments when the mood subsides, when we're feeling something different, when we're perhaps are quite calm and peaceful in ourselves, not having the distortion, we look around and suddenly nothing seems depressed like it was. Nothing seems I don't need to defend myself the way I needed to during the mood. And why is it that we don't see that as that disproves the mood? Because when we're back in it, we then assume the whole governance, the whole view, the whole stance that the mood takes. And we just assume that this is the way life is. That's what the mood says. This is the way life is. Look how terrible life is treating me. So I think that a person of awareness begins to mistrust moods deeply. And we have we can get a sense that thought may lead us astray, but we think that moods are a truer depiction of reality, and that they somehow are the kind of the bottom line, the foundation on which reality sits. And we can see that thoughts may be distorted, but moods we attribute much more grounded reality than they deserve. They don't deserve any more reality than the thought. They're another conditioned phenomena within us. And they should not be taken as fact, no matter what mood we're in. It's so interesting, at some point, you will see that whatever emotional response you have, whatever mood in, has nothing to do with the external projection at all. So you're angry at something. You have an emotion of anger or annoyance or frustration. That there is no connection between that anger and the projection, the person, the event that the anger is associated with. None. And when you see that, it can be rather startling because your emotions then don't say anything about what's true and transpiring. And to begin to release the need for the world to be propagated, to be stimulated through our emotional life, so you see, I mean, just as we talk about moods, you can feel that the mood is always in motion. It's not a steady state. It's something that it's finite. It has a beginning and an end. Now, if we live with that mood long enough and we begin to perceive the world in accordance with that mood, then the very thinking that we do will start reinforcing that feeling. And the mood will become relatively continuous. In fact, it will become a kind of stance of character that we take. We may have had a very difficult childhood in which there was a lot of abuse. And from that very scarring past, we have assumed a particular character relationship to life itself, say mistrust. And that mood of mistrust or that need to protect and defend and contract around anything new can live long beyond the relatively finite time in which we were actually physically abused. And we can perpetuate that conditioning for years, decades, a lifetime, or more, extenuating it out, constantly reaffirming it, because we're set to see life from the governance of that mood. We perceive life from the perception and the readied perception that the mood takes. And therefore, events are translated in accordance to the mood to authenticate that mood, to prove it right. Because proving it right becomes the very way that we become validated. See, it's not a small thing we're looking at. We're looking at the mind here. We're looking at how we have fallen into the heavy hand of conditioning. And we have taken it on with such belief and with such intimate detail and such personal reactivity. How are we to free ourselves but to go into these very deep abiding states that have convinced us throughout our whole life, and to ask, to look at these things anew, to address them head on. So all the distortions of mind we are doing in this series really has that freeing effect. To be able to pass through the transparency, because none of them are hard, none of them are opaque, none of them are three-dimensional. None of them are a certainty. It's all just, it's like looking up at the sky in the day and forming patterns out of the clouds shapes. And being, wow, really seeing, you know, an elephant in that cloud. Someone said, even our past has a life of its own. It isn't just what we have touched. It is what we have felt about what you have touched, what we have touched. See, it's not just what we've done, but it's the feeling tone that it had when it occurred leaves its mental trace in us. And that trace of conditioning, that feeling tone, is ready to arise when the similar situation, event, or experience might arise again. And so there's a kind of emotional story that the world contains and invites just upon contact, just upon perception, just upon the availability of an event to memory. So let's look at how emotions might arise, because if we're not clear about how emotions arise, emotions then can form into the very mood states that perpetuate themselves on and on into the years. So let's just talk a little bit about the way emotions arise. One is what the Buddha calls dependent arising. An emotion, an event, an experience creates, occurs. And from that arising of an event, from an arising of an experience, an emotion also arises. The Buddha calls this dependent arising. How to explain dependent arising? Well, you might think, when the snow falls, there are certain conditions that have to be present in order for snow to fall. Now, you can't say that those conditions were the cause of the snow, but those conditions had to be present for snow to arise. The temperature had to be a certain degree. There had to be a certain humidity in the air or whatever, right? And when those conditions are present, then snow arises, snow comes. So too, when certain conditions are present, a certain mood arises, a certain emotion arises within us. To see it in this way, to see it as just the arising, a dependent arising from whatever conditioned phenomena might be taking place in this moment, gives it a kind of impersonality, an impersonal quality to it, which is essential when you look at emotions, because we're so tied to the personal quality of the emotion. And they really, it does show you, that reactivity, when it's conditioned, like a bell, like a salivating dog, when it rings a bell, the bell doesn't cause the dog to salivate. It's the condition that arises at the time that salivation occurs. And that conditioned link is what creates the moods within us as well. So then that mood grabs the event that's closest at hand and covers it with our history, our emotional history, and then it's guilt by association. It's like we meet somebody who reminds us of our mother, and then we start treating that person as if we were with our mother, either hostily or other possibilities. The person had nothing to do with the emotional reaction that we have with a face that's similar to that. I mean, I can't tell you how many notes I get about fathers and how I remind you, as if it were my fault. And the notes often have a kind of viciousness to them, as if I was supposed to own responsibility for looking like somebody's father or behaving like somebody's father. And we really hold life to be responsible for our reactivity when it has nothing to do with it, really. It has nothing to do with it at all. Okay, what's this? Another way, a second way a mood can unlock itself and arise. Sometimes there can be no incident or event that that arises with the mood at all. For instance, sometimes when we wake up from sleep, we're in a mood. Where did that come from? I think it comes out of the body, actually. I think it arises on its own, out of the body, from previous conditioning, having been instilled in the body. And we might just wake up angry. And maybe it has something to do with dreams, but I don't know that. And you just wake up annoyed or wake up in a bad mood. And all day long, we carry forth that bad mood. And it's like a disease that we contaminate. We're contagious and contaminate others with the same disease. I don't know how many of you have had the experience in sitting, when you're just sitting. And oftentimes the body, you can feel the body being restless or just in some kind of physical stimulation. You can feel it. And then a mood will arise from that. Or if you ever had deep massage, where somebody will, in their deep massage, an emotion will come out. What's the cause of that? You see, the mind does not like a mood without a cause. It gets up from a night's sleep and it's angry and it looks for reasons to prove that anger has validity. So it'll be angry at something that you never would have been angry at had you not arisen with that mood. We don't realize that the mood speaks. It's the mood that's speaking. And we don't allow the mood to be quiet. It's very difficult to be quiet with a mood. It's we have to justify having this mood. When the mood arises, we have to justify why it's there. We have to find an excuse, a reason, so that we feel validated. We feel, okay, now it's okay, yeah, it's because you and this and that, and you remember yesterday and... And then another time, when it's not there, it's like everything's okay. All the things you did yesterday were really fine. And it can be 10 minutes later, can't it? And the mood doesn't speak anymore from us. What was speaking during that time? Why was the world so certain during the mood? How many times do we have to go through this before we wake up to the falseness of this mood? I have a relative who is extremely moody, and she doesn't realize how controlling her moods are onto others. And, or maybe she does. Maybe that's one of the benefits she gets from being moody. Because everybody sort of sidesteps trying to get her back into a good mood. Because it's so heavy when you walk into the house when she isn't in a good mood. And it's just, I mean, you can just feel it. It's like molasses walking in there. And how controlling, how it may be unconscious, it may not be a conscious attempt to control, but the mood controls can be so powerful, have such a powerful effect on others as they try to sort of get out of the way of the contaminating influence of the mood. And the third way that an emotion can arise is the mind can just seethe on itself. You know that one? Especially on retreat, or when you're sitting and supposed to be following the breath, and something comes up, and you just seethe on it, so that it becomes isolated. There's just one mind corralling it. Right? We have no other input. You can't check it out. Which is the reason the teacher is on retreat, by the way. because the mind can conjure up a whole storyline around a particular incident, usually a mood, and then seethe upon itself, kind of just feed the fires of that seething. We call it, in the tradition, in its lighter expression, we call it yogi mind. Yogi mind is when the mind can't get out of its own projection and really believes the truth of its projection. And then it starts acting out that truth. And it's really funny to see, and it happens to all of us at some point. It certainly happened to me many times. Often in terms of romances you have with somebody who you've never met. And you go through the whole life cycle of a marriage and divorce and children, and it, you know, nothing's ever been said between you, not a word. But in its more ominous tone, it's a kind of way that we're afraid to even talk about it because we're so convinced that it's true, or about ourselves, about our doubting, about our incompetence, about our incapability. And we won't even share it because we don't think that we want anyone else to see what we have proven to be true, because we've seized upon it. And we have shown all the facts of evidence that support the conjecture. And we have validated this in ourselves to our satisfaction. It's no longer a theory. It's the truth. And that is when it becomes insidious within us. It seethes. And sometimes, the problem is that we're also training the mind in concentration. When the mind is concentrated, it collapses around something. Concentration does not can be wise or unwise. Just to have a concentrated focus, the ability to focus on something. A thief is well focused, but that isn't wise attention, right? So attention per se can be unwise or wise. But what attention does do is that it creates a conduit, a narrow corridor of thought in which the thing, the emotion, is held with such intensity that the conviction of the emotion is exaggerated. And so because we are also training concentration within our practice, when we do prolonged retreats, usually on prolonged retreats, this simultaneous arising of the conviction of the mood and the concentration state can be a rather very delicate betrayal of our whole practice if it's not shared. And that's why one of the safer ways to practice is in daily life, when you have a multiple feedback, people talking to you, telling you what they see, so that that multiple feedback allows you to come out of yourself a little and not to hold with such containment your ideas about yourself. A teacher, for instance, doesn't get a lot of feedback. Well, we get a lot of positive feedback. We get negative feedback, but often it's vicious because you get that. But mostly it's, people don't want to test their relationship with a teacher by giving true feedback. And so there can be a relatively isolated position to be teaching, and one that I know for my own, that I need my peers, my teaching partners to teach with. And that's why it's healthy, I think, to teach with people, because they can give you, they can say, well, what about this, and why are you doing this, what's going on here, and you listen, because they aren't holding back anything. And that's just one of the sort of the state of affairs of being in this position. But we don't have to do that. The body here, all of you, the body of the community, can use each other in discussion groups and how you listen to each other to break out of this kind of incrustation of our own mental formation. In which that mood will just, you just keep cooking with the same ingredients, you know. And you just overcook it so that you can't reach any other conclusion about yourself except the one you've lived with your whole life. And you never test it because you're afraid to test it. To test it would prove the accuracy of your projection, according to what many of us think. And so we just stay with the attitude. You see, I want to show that no attitude is true. There is no truth to any attitude. None. You can find no external or internal justification for whatever you're feeling. Never. Now, what are you going to do? You going to let those feelings bait us and swallow the hook? Or are you going to let them pass through on their way? On their way. When we're not clouded, when we're not confused by the issue of our moods, then we have the possibility of seeing without those moods. Spaciously, not governed. Sight is no longer governed by the distortion of the glass. Now you can see with clarity. Now we can see the way things are as opposed to the way the mood translates and interprets reality. And then you can take the necessary precautions or adjustments or do whatever is necessary for you to be skillful within that action, but it won't be governed by an emotional belief. Because again, no emotion is true. It's all projection. Isn't that amazing? And we just, and each perception tries to validate the mood it's having by seeing that perception in a certain context. So all new perceptions are seen through the distortion of the mood and thereby validate the mood. And we can't get ourselves out of that because we have no way of having any other messages, any other thing coming in, any other resources, any other ways to perceive. And that's the fix that most of us find ourselves in much of the time. There was a friend of mine went to a dentist. And this dentist wasn't here in town. Started to talk to him about the different patients that come to see him and how he knew that some of them were communist spies. This was 20 years ago. And he could tell by the clothes they wore whether they were coming in as spies to get his secrets by some kind of intra-psychic, you know, just like, you get the message, right? This guy, with total paranoia. And the guy says, well, how'd you know I wasn't a spy? He says, because you're wearing informal clothes. And he had just taken off his tie to come to the chair. So it was just that one act that had saved him. And he didn't know what how the drilling would go if he hadn't taken off his tie. I think that story is worth remembering, that we are always in the hands of other people's perceptions, other people's moods, other people's self-validating beliefs. And each of us hold the world to substantiate our beliefs within it. Now, most of us aren't that paranoid or that distorted of thinking because we have some, we allow input that comes in and rearranges that distortion. But if left alone long enough, most of us probably would start going off in those kind of directions without input. So we have an emotion, and we try to justify the reason that we have an emotion, don't we? I'm feeling this because you said that. And then the perception of being angry at that person becomes tied to the person so that other things they do we can be angry at as well. And so the extension of the mood moves beyond the particular incident that led to the arising of the mood in the beginning. And then the reason, the justification, no longer has to be there. Suddenly the person carries the mood when they're present. And if we live long enough with that person, then when the person leads, the mood remains because we've become so familiarly governed by that mood that we start setting up shop within that mood. And that mood then becomes the way that we know ourselves. And it no longer needs validation. It no longer needs an incident in order to provoke it. And we carry it out. Anxiety, free-floating anxiety is a perfect example. Long ago, when we were very small, the incidences of fear engendered a kind of way of holding, a perceptual holding of life itself. And now life itself has suddenly become that which we are anxious about. Forgetting what was associated with the anger originally, it now becomes generalized to all of life. So I get out of the bed and I'm fearful. Isn't it time we stopped and said, let me look at this. Let me look at this. This insanity. And how am I feeding it? How am I feeding it? How am I encouraging it? Who are we without that mood? What are we without that mood? Is it so important to us to be depressed, anxious, fearful, pitied? Angry? See, who would we be? Anger is, when you're just always annoyed and just always put upon. So that now I can sit back and be, oh, this is me, this is who I am. All starting from the need to justify an emotion that arises by blame, by association. Rather than to be accountable, to be responsible for it, to be accountable to it. The feeling we're having, I can feel that. So what? Why go out and paint the world? Why not just hold it? And when we do hold it, it's a mist. It's porous. It's translucent. It's like the space, the fog in the morning here in Seattle, the fog. I can't walk through that fog. Why not? to look at why it is. What's the payoff of our moods? What's the payoff? What do we get from being... We really have to look at this and to assess what it is that we're getting out of something. We wouldn't promote it. We wouldn't even unconsciously repeat it. We wouldn't keep taking that stance unless there was a payoff to us. Maybe the strong sense of self-indignation against the whole world who's trying to, you know, that feeling of the world against me. That strong sense of I. Or maybe it's because it does control others and we like the ability to control others through our mood. And unconsciously or perhaps subconsciously we realize that. So we play out our moods. And also, I don't have to be accountable. When you step around my moods, I never have to be accountable to my moods at all. You see? And in some way this adds to the strength, character strength that we think of. So what are some of the things we can do about a mood? Well, we have a homework sheet back there I hope you take seriously this week. First, am I aware that the mood is occurring? Am I aware of that? Right now, as we sit, am I aware of whatever attitude might be for me? Secondly, what is my relationship to this mood? Am I afraid of it? Do I feed it through my fear? Thirdly, can I see it for what it is, rather than making anything substantial out of it? Can I just see it for what it is? A neediness, a fear, an annoyance, a frustration. Can I just see an emotion as an emotion, rather than invite an entity or three-dimensionality into that projection? Can I stop blaming it and be completely accountable? Can I just let it rest with what's going on, just as part of the dimension of my inward life? What's the payoff I'm getting from this thing? And is it worth the payoff? Because where there's a payoff, there's a pain, there's a price that we pay. Now let me look at the pain of the assumption of that mood. Let me look where it holds me so deeply with such adhesiveness to the sense of who I am that I may even refuse to let the mood go for fear that I wouldn't know myself without it. See how much fear governs everything. And can I see the transparency of this mood? Leaving it alone. Just being present. Let presence, let it come into the field of presence. Where nothing is substantiated. Nothing is fixed. To wakefulness itself that cannot be covered, cannot be colored, cannot be confiscated. And therefore abides in freedom. Thank you. Can we sit for a minute or two?